Good evening and welcome, dear ones. So good to see each of your faces once again this evening. So tonight, as always, we have the Christ candle that has been lit as the essential light of life, of being, that is always with us, underlying and within and through everything that we are doing. And tonight, excuse me, again, we are honoring those in particular who've gone before us as wayshowers and friends of God. And in the month of October, there are a number of those beloveds of us who have died and gone to the next world. So we begin in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, God transcendent, God omnipresent, God immanent, the holy living trinity of being. Amen. This evening, as does today's email, honors and remembers Mr. Gurdjieff, an extraordinary being whose works are still largely unknown and perhaps even misunderstood by those who are aware of him, though they have been gifted to us in a very special way. He died on October 29th, 1949. And so tonight we will hear a story that was written by Louise March, one of those who worked with Mr. Gurdjieff on Beelzebub's Tales, and she was the translator of Beelzebub's Tales into German. So this is a reading from her book entitled The Gurdjieff Years, 1929 to 1949, in the chapter entitled The Final Days. When I returned to Gurdjieff's Paris flat, he immediately sent me on an overnight trip to London to arrange the press releases for the English version of the book. Before I left, Gurdjieff said, "We wait lunch for you." In London, I worked deep into the night with people in the English groups, considering the question, what to give to the press. My formulation of Beelzebub's Tales as a, quote, cosmic fairy tale was used in the press release. I was back in Paris by 4 o'clock the following afternoon, for lunch at Mr. Gurdjieff's table. In the fall, Gurdjieff sent me back to Vienna to continue working on the German edition. I left Paris with a concern about his deteriorating health. One of the former Ouspensky people kept me posted about his condition. When he entered the hospital, I was called back to Paris. As I was flying over Stuttgart on October 29th, 1949, I knew that Gurdjieff had died. Upon my arrival in Paris, I called Madame de Salzman, and she confirmed the fact of his death. Together, we went to the American hospital where his body lay. As Madame de Salzman and I stood beside him, I remembered and was reminded of the two Marys at the death of Christ. The funeral service took place in the Russian Orthodox Church in the Rue Daru. The congregation stood in absolute silence for an hour, waiting for the coffin to arrive. The priest at the church was struck by the congregation's composure. Later, he asked, "What did the man Gurdjieff teach? For my whole life, I've wanted a congregation like this." Just as the funeral ended, the electric power in the church failed. In fact, the lights went out in the entire quarter of Paris. Was Gurdjieff making a little joke? He had said innumerable times, "When my teaching understood, will not be any more electric light." Gurdjieff was buried at the Avon Cemetery, between the graves of his wife and his mother, whose tombstones had bent towards each other. So, Mr. Gurdjieff, we honor your life and your teaching. May we come to understand it in some way, and more importantly, to embody it in possibility for ourselves. Amen. So now, taking the sense of reverence and quiet that is evoked by the remembrance of his death, excuse me, we prepare ourselves to remember, to begin to see, to work on the side of knowledge, to experience this knowledge with real valuation, with a real feeling, to receive it quietly, opening our minds to what is ours to hear at this time. This matters to our very selves, for one another, for our world. We place ourselves with imminent trust and receptivity to the influences coming to us from the circle of conscious humanity, and we prepare to be awake to them, to consciously receive them. With back upright, heart open, mind quiet and directed attention, body relaxed, noticing perhaps and then releasing any tension, constriction, resistance. We breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything, everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy. All affirming, all denying. And we hold it as offering, reconciled as food for being. As whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. As we ourselves are beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I open to the divine human life that has been gifted to me. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. And so now we enter into our time of Lectio Divina, and we share a reading from today's email. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or something else. But God gives it a body as God has determined. And to each kind of seed, God gives its own body. In contemplating our own personal destiny, it is the choice between whether our life has any meaning and the certainty that in the scheme of things, we have a necessary part to play, and the peace and satisfaction of the one who quits the scene with debts paid and duty done. We must die to the unknown and enter the unknown, the complete stillness, the only state in which we can find out what life is and what love is. Deep down in my being, I am already what I seek. This is the impetus of the whole search. May we bequeath to those attending the end of our days a story of a divine life that is faithful to the struggle of being fully human when the seduction and pull is so much otherwise. A story so true and indelible that it shines best and brightest in the darkest time, like stars in a clear country sky night. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or something else. But God gives it a body, as God has determined. And to each kind of seed, God gives its own body. In contemplating our own personal destiny, it is the choice between whether our life has any meaning and the certainty that in the scheme of things, we have a necessary part to play, and the peace and satisfaction of the one who quits the scene with debts paid and duty done. We must die to the known and enter the unknown, the complete stillness, the only state in which we can find what life is and what love is. Deep down in my being, I am already what I seek. This is the impetus of the whole search. May we bequeath to those attending the end of our days a story of a dying life that is faithful to the struggle of being fully human when the seduction and pull is so much otherwise. A story so true and indelible that it shines bright and brightest in the darkest time, like stars in a clear country sky night. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or something else. but God gives it a body as God has determined. And to each kind of seed, God gives its own body. In contemplating our own personal destiny, it is the choice between whether our life has any meaning and the certainty that in the scheme of things, we have a necessary part to play, and the peace and satisfaction of the one who quits the scene with debts paid and duty done. We must die to the known and enter the unknown, the complete stillness, the only state in which we can find out what life is and what love is. Deep down in my being, I am already what I seek. This is the impetus of the whole search. May we bequeath to those attending the end of our days a story of a dying life that is faithful to the struggle of being fully human when the seduction and pull is so much otherwise. A story so true and indelible that it shines bright and brightest in the darkest time, best and brightest in the darkest time, like stars in a clear country sky night. And so it is. So I invite you to share the reflections of your heart upon the reading of this passage, or perhaps the image came to meet you and a message was given to you. Jim, good evening.
Hi, Marianne. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay. I was hoping the image and the reading would stay on the screen, so I'm going to have to remember. Yeah. Initially this evening, even though I looked at that all week, I was struck by the fact that it just seemed to be a very disconnected picture. And then I realized I always think of skeletons as male. Mm-hmm. So I guess women don't have skeletons, but there's something about the way we portray skeletons as being this time of year spooky and that sort of thing, that it's hard to picture the beautiful and fully dressed woman on the right being a dead and decomposing skeleton. But then the rest of the reading was just things that are all very, very very front and center to me right now. We're working with our will and all those documents you're supposed to have signed before you check out of this life. And that always seemed like a silly waste of time until I finally hit the point where I was over 65 and realized I am going to die and I need to take care of some things for my kids. So Bev and I are working on that, and we're hoping in the next week to actually sign the documents we've been struggling with for several months over the past year. And that includes some very particular things in working with our children and our estate. Not that we have a complicated estate, but it's a little bit unusual in terms of our housing as we get older. But then the section in the middle, and I don't have it in front of me again, but the whole idea of being able to die, knowing that your debts are paid and that you have achieved your aim, is something that I have been really noticing in the past 5 years or so. And so my aim is really around that area. It's to feel like my life has counted for something in particular. And as someone who's still working, I tend to view that in terms of a career. But I think if we can frame that in a way that's bigger than just a career, then it can, the same aim can serve us even if we're not working.
Yes.
So I found this entire reading to be filled with things to ponder and to consider. And so I'm really thankful for it. And this week, particularly coming into Halloween, where we often have some cultural associations and things relating to skeletons and death that are really more silly than serious.
Yes,
So
indeed.
thank you for all of that.
No, you're welcome, Jim. Thank you for your reflections. So, Jim, good evening. Another Jim. You have to unmute, Jim.
There we go.
Yes.
Yes, the sentence that that struck me was, deep down in my being, I am already what I seek, which gave me a great reassurance that that if I persevere and am faithful to this journey that I'm on, that I will indeed find what God has called me to seek, which is my, I believe anyway, my own authentic self,
yes,
my real self. And whether I find it before I die or after I die, in either case, it will have made the journey worth, well worth pursuing. So,
yes, thank you, Jim.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Well, it looks like we have Jim number three. So you're welcome, Jim. And then afterwards, we'll have Tracy and then Pamela or Michael, and then we'll close that part of this evening. But right now, Jim, we'll listen and ponder with you.
Thank you. This whole conversation and the whole focus this week on death, I have been reading A Course in Miracles, and lesson number seven has made it clear to me that the sleeping me, I see only the past. And I had a waking dream and image of looking at the wake behind a large ship on which I was standing on the stern of, in a kind of gray sky, sea with a gray sky. And it occurred to me that it's incumbent upon me to walk to the bow and look into the future with my heart and my eyes in a way that I've never really done before, and to embrace the adventure of the end of this life, facing it directly. And that's what was affirmed by the reading tonight.
Amen for all of us. Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy.
I was hit with a stillness of the profoundness. Just there was a depth there that the identities cannot comprehend, but that the I am already knows the true self, that higher peace. And I have to say, because Pamela and Michael have their hand raised, that picture reminds me of something. It just reminded me of Pamela the minute I saw it. So anyway, that's it. But I am in a state of stillness over that. And it was interesting because I came in kind of agitated, but it just made me realize how little I know. And that any effort can be wasted or useful, and it just depends on how I'm taking it. And even that, I question the eyes that are watching. So it's just, it was very beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. So Pamela or Michael or both, welcome, both of you.
I'm the one that wants to share, but Tracy, that's so funny that you saw me in that image. I love that image because it tells the truth. I want to be able to look in a mirror and actually see that every day, to see Pamela in process and Pamela on the edge of something else or in another realm, and to just have that before me always. So that was one thing. And the second thing was the phrase, debts paid and duty done. Mm-hmm. Reminded me of the five Obligonian strivings.
Yes.
But in particular for me, I'm very aware of creating, both paying off my karma and not creating new karma. Even when I'm driving, when I'm interacting with other people, I'm very aware that every action, every interaction can create a debt. If I'm not awake and aware, I'm aware of unforgiveness. And I don't want to leave this realm with unforgiveness, with that kind of debt. There's just so many small ways that debts show up, and I'm ever more aware of what they are. And what I owe for my own arising. So I appreciated that phrase and that image together. Thank you.
Thank you, Pamela. May it be so. And thank you to everyone who shared, and for all of us in the thoughts of our hearts. It is auspicious, the timing of this message, the deaths of those that were such teachers for us, and just this particular time, stepping into the unknown. So Steve, I am very pleased to welcome Steve Utz, who will accompany us on our journey this evening. Thank you, Steve, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Marianne. Can everyone hear me well? Good. What I'd like to do tonight is save the homework for our discussion period later, because I'm going to give everyone a new homework assignment to do simultaneously with this presentation. And that is consider the three lines of the work in view of our dying. So as I would look at this, just to kind of set the stage a little bit, the first thing would be, what would my reaction be to my own end? And how would I process that? So there's work to be done in that arena. And then there would be, how am I going to process that in relation to my wife or my daughter? And how do I engage with their Enneagram type and their personalities, and work through that and be considerate of that and externally consider? And then finally, the third line of the work is, what does my death mean? What does my life mean? And how do I hold to that sense of duty and conscience and purpose? So just we could think about that as we're going through this presentation. And I've given talks on this before. I gave a homily on the dying body. It was back in 2022, but that was more of a what the experience might be like. But what we're called to do here is remembering our dying and what that means to us all. So I'm going to do a brief overview of our cultural attitudes about dying. And then I want to quickly dispense with that and move into focusing on some images for the emotional center. Because I tend to live in an intellectual center a lot. So it's a stretch for me to kind of seep into emotional center. And so I want to really devote most of the talk to that. So I was I'm a retired physician. I was in practice for 45 years, and in many different capacities. I was stationed in the Air Force in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I moonlighted at an emergency room in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and also in Past Christian and some other places. And so I brought my internal medicine skills to those settings, but I saw death. I saw terrible auto accidents and infants killed and just awful stuff. And in the course of my career, probably was witness to tens of thousands of deaths and how the many different ways people approach death, and then how our culture interacted with that. And then, and if you think of the history of medical science, in 1912, 60% of the people, 60% of the population died at home. There wasn't much to do in the hospital. Occasionally, you'd go to the hospital because nobody else could deal with it, maybe pain control, whatever, but 60% died at home. By the time we got to 1950, 50% were dying in the hospital and 50% at home. By the time we got to 1980, 26% were dying at home and 74% were dying in the hospital. So it's almost like we went through the traditional era in through the modernist era into the postmodernist era. So now we're realizing that's not a good place to die. And so the shift is shifting towards dying at home. So at least culturally, we're moving it back, but we still suffer with a disconnected healthcare system. No one knows if we've done enough because nobody understands what the system's doing. And the physicians in the system are all disconnected. No, there is no one person controlling things. It used to be in the olden days, your family doctor would put you in the hospital and he'd take care of everything. He might occasionally call a specialist, but you knew him for your whole life and you knew he'd do right by you. But now you're in this anonymous sphere. You just don't know who's in charge of what. And so it takes a certain need, it requires of us to step forward and to dictate what we want our dying to be. And we have to have values about it. We have to have discussions about it. I find it's amazing to me how few people have discussed a living will, have discussed end-of-life care, have discussed their philosophy about it in depth, because it's not just checking boxes. It's not just, do you want to be resuscitated or not? What's your general sense of how you want to die? And my personal experience, it was a struggle with my mother's death. She had an end-stage emphysema back in 2004, was in and out of the hospital due to various things. She then broke her hip, was in the hospital. That impacted her overall COPD recovery. And she ended up deteriorating and diminishing. And she finally, in her last hospitalization, said, I don't want to come back here. I feel the wind coming out of my cells. She sensed what was coming. And I told this story before, but I came over after her, the night of her 55th wedding anniversary, and made her a martini. And she said, you know, I'm not afraid of dying, but I just wish I'd been more spiritual in my life, and it's too late for that. And I told her that, well, when you go up to the pearly gates, you're going to set down two big heavy suitcases and you're going to feel as free as a bird. And so she kind of liked that as she dumped the rest of that martini. But and then the next morning, she rested. She had been in the hospital and filled out all these forms so that she wouldn't be resuscitated out of the hospital. But they ran out of the wristbands. Obviously not a priority to the system. And so therefore these manila folders are sitting on the coffee table that nobody looks at. The code is called, EMS comes, they resuscitate her, and they got her back. And I had to rush over there and say, no, stop. This is not what she wanted. And I had to throw my weight around, which I can do if I have to, and called the head of the EMS and said, look, I'm a physician and I'm not gonna tolerate this. This just cannot happen. And they stopped and she passed. So the system has these gears in it that won't turn. And as a society, we have to change it. And it's turning around now. The percent of people that die at home in this day and age is back to 40%. And we're in this postmodern age, we're understanding this is a preferable place to be. But we still have not overcome our fear of dying. We are embedded in this world. We are caught up with this world. And we've lost touch with nature. We've lost touch with the reality of dying. And even though that trend is occurring, people just don't die at home that much. We did this tour of Ireland, and there was this Irish dairy farmer. And he lived in this house. His family lived in that house forever. Grandfather, great-grandfather, all the way back. And his grandfather, and he pointed to the back bedroom, and he said, my grandfather was born there, and my grandfather died there. And my father was born there, and my father died there. And I was born there, and I will die there. There's a continuity, a sense of something greater than yourself that connects you to a greater purpose that helps you with dying. And that's what I'm intending to unpack tonight, emotionally. So enough about our culture today. I'm going to start to share the screen. And I have my PowerPoint up somewhere. Let me pull it up. There we are. And go to the slideshow. And here we go. I did a cloud motif because that's how most of us envision our dying, is going up into the clouds. But I think it'll serve us well for this talk. So what I'd like to do is paint a few emotional scenes. And I'm going to start with this slide. And this is Howard Thurman, one of my heroes. And I've shared about him before. He wrote this book called Jesus and the Disinherited, which was in the hip pocket of every civil rights leader, going back to Martin Luther King and John Lewis and Ralph Abernathy and Jesse Jackson. He was an inspiration. And this is a quote from him. Look well to the growing age. All around us, worlds are dying and new worlds are being born. Life is dying and new life is being born. The fruit ripens on the tree, The roots are silently at work in the darkness of the earth against the time when there shall be new lives, fresh blossoms, green fruit. Such is the growing edge, the birth of a child, life's most dramatic answer to death. This is the growing edge incarnate. Look well to the growing edge. And then this thing came across the internet. It's a tree stump and a human fingerprint. So if you look to the left, that's a 50-year-old tree. You can tell by the rings. You count the rings, you got 50 rings. On the right is a human fingerprint, and it almost looks exactly the same. And that, to me, signals this internal resonance of all of nature. We are all kind of different versions of the same thing. And that thumbprint is imprinted on the finger as early as 17 weeks of gestation. Not 17 weeks old, 17 weeks of gestation. And it's designed for our sensory apparatus so we can grasp and touch and perceive things. So isn't that interesting? And I had to put the tree and the fingerprint together. And then the next day, a Rilke poem came across, and it said this: through every being, single space extends, outer space within. Through us, the birds fly silently. Oh, I who'd grow, I look outside, and in me grows a tree. So there's serendipity for you. So I'm going to start now with a brief meditation from Jim Finley. And I've shared some stuff from Jim Finley in the past. He was one of the faculty members at Living School, a very deep spiritual man who had studied with Thomas Merton at Gethsemane Monastery. So I'm going to start with this. I invite you to join me in a poetic meditation on the mysterious circular nature of the healing path. To begin the meditation, I invite you to imagine a woman holding her newborn infant son. She is amazed in a quiet, interior kind of way by how small her infant is, weighing hardly anything at all. As she gazes into her infant's unknowing eyes, she keenly senses how limited her infant is in so many ways. Her newborn infant cannot feed himself, nor can he roll over by himself or sit up or stand up and walk about from one place to another. Her infant cannot engage with her in meaningful conversations or chip in and help with the chores. In these and in countless other ways as well, her infant son embodies the essence of limit. And yet, with the imperial strength with which her infant clasps her extended little finger, like a king holding a scepter, how limitless her infant is in the midst of his limitations. She is left knowing in the deep down depths of herself that if she were to die in the act of saving the life of her infant, she would die to the truth. As years go by, her adult son becomes aware that as his mother grows older, she is becoming increasingly fragile and limited in so many ways. Finally, at long last, he is sitting at his mother's bedside as she lies quiet and still in her final moments of life on this earth. As he sits next to her, listening to her labored breathing, He is moved in the deep down depths of himself in realizing how strange it is that his mother, who once held him in the limitations of his infancy, has now herself become limited in so many ways. She cannot sit up by herself. She cannot stand up and walk about from one place to another. Nor can she engage with him in one of the loving conversations they have so appreciated over the years. As he gazes into her unknowing eyes, he sadly realizes that she shows no signs of knowing who he is. Nor is there any sign that she remembers who she was in her own life on this earth. In these and in so many ways as well, he intimately realizes that his mother has become the essence of limit. And yet, with the imperial strength with which she clasps his extended little finger, like a queen holding a scepter, she all but carries his heart away. He knows, in the deep down depths of himself, something of the divine dimensions of the mysterious circular nature of her journey through time, from birth to death. And I think we'll sit with this for about 20 seconds. Now, this from Stephen Jenkinson. Stars. It's dark. You are standing in a field far from the house. This is the midnight sky of your younger, wilder days. It is ablaze, aching with stars. It is the vault of heaven. Indigo sea of time pierced by light from the other side. The horizons are gone, and the bridge of sighs, the one they say the dead walk to leave this world, dazzles you. Every idea you have seems too small for the world. The blessings tumble. Someone looks up into the night sky and says, "You see that star there? Could it be that it isn't there anymore?" All conviction is sent reeling. Nothing is truer than this. The mysteries roll. You are welcome. You need witnesses for wonder. Wonder takes a willingness to be uncertain, to be thrown. We have a lot of information these days, and few are enamored of imprecision or subtlety. But starlight, traveling a bewildering distance for so long that there's every chance that it doesn't even exist anymore, and all of that has already happened, and you are standing there, your face blazed in the dark by a starlight god, seeing it all, what is and what isn't there, enthroned by your witness. That is a marvel, and surely that is how awe is born in us. The night of wonder must be a long one, and sometime before dawn, it will come to this. When I die, am I past? Am I gone? Lost? This is when the midnight sky, riven by all the light givers that have been, starts whispering, "You can see this, that something isn't there anymore. And you have more proof than you need that the past is not quite past." What will happen when I die? I'm counting on more. The times of dying, of real and proper sorrow, could be woven by a gratitude for being around long enough to be overwhelmed by something that happens every day, by ordinary awe. And each of us could be gathered in by the raveling covenant of sorrow and thanksgiving as our days end. Here's what happens every day. The past has a tangible presence and isn't gone. People are born and people die. And there are signs. And this is also from Stephen Jenkinson. A good seaman loves the sea at times, heeds its signs and portents other times, might even hate it. When he loses his senses and comes to them later and then realizes it is something of himself that he was hating. But a good seaman, fighting the sea, he doesn't. He wrestles the sea by sailing on it and making his way. Suffering, learning how to suffer, is how you make meaning for what seems random, chaotic, or pointless. That is what I mean about wrestling. Meaning comes from this kind of wrestling. Try it this way. What if you're dying as an angel? And what if your dying job, should you choose to accept it, is to wrestle this angel of your dying instead of fighting it? What if you wrestle the angel of your dying life instead of fighting the executioner of your disease? Let the difference between these two unfold a little. Wrestling is a different thing entirely. Wrestling has choreography. The purpose of dancing or any choreographed thing isn't to get to the end, to have it be over, to resolve it, to let go, to accept. The purpose is to move, to dance. Wrestling has an intimacy to it that fighting will never obtain. Wrestling is articulation. The elegant courage of singing and dancing when the song and the dance tend as they do towards silence, knowing it will end. Living your way of life wrestles the way of life from being itself. That is how meaning is made. And you turn your dying into a question instead of an edict. So Steve Jenkinson sums this up with sort of a mission statement for us. We could be a trustworthy achievement. We could bequeath to the young people attending to the end of our days, often at too much of a distance, and to the children and babies who have no memory of us at all, a story of a dying life that is faithful to the struggle of being human when the seduction and the pull is so much otherwise. A story so true and indelible that it shines best and brightest in the darkest time, like stars on a clear country sky night. And Father Keating echoes this. He says, death seems to be a process of transformation. For that reason, it's not really death, but life reaching out to a fullness that we can't imagine from this side of the dying process. So death is not the end of anything, but the final completion of this process of becoming fully alive and manifesting the triumph of the grace of God in us. And, you know, it's not old monks that have wisdom, too. I mean, there's young folks, too. And this is a group called Big Thief, one of my favorite new groups. The guy on the left here, far left, is Buck Meeks. He and his brother Dylan Meeks used to play around Wimberley at these different restaurants like Linda's and Kate's and sometimes at the cafe. And he married this gal, Adrienne Lenker. And this album, Dragon Warm Mountain, I Believe in You, is just a beautiful album. And there's this song called Change that she sings with this immediacy and presence, compares it to wind, water, and skin, and like the sky, the leaves, and a butterfly. But it posed this question that I rattled around in my brain for a little. Would you live forever and never die while everything around you passes? And would you smile forever and never cry while everything you know passes? And death is like a door to a place we've never been before. It's to the unknown, like a lot of things, like space, the deep sea, and even the ending of a relationship, like a suitcase. And then would you ever stare forever at the sun and never watch the moon rise? And would you walk forever in the light and never learn the secret of the quiet night? So we need both. We need that contrast. And I don't want to scare you with this. I know it's ray of creation diagrams, but I just want to point out that how the ray of creation forms and involutes is it adds triangles to the outside, but the center is always in the center. It's always in the center, always in the center. And as God involutes us, we evolve out. We go back to the center. We go back to the center. That's what this slice is telling us. And this is a thing that I really, it's a revelation I received from Cynthia Bergeau that agape love is like brass. It's not a natural element. It is formed by combining two other metals, copper and whatever else adds to make brass. Agape love does not exist in a natural state. It's an alchemical substance forged when the raw primal force eros is subjected to the sacramental act of surrender or kenosis. And then it's wordy here, but finitude is a necessary condition for the final revelation of love. It furnishes the backboard for surrender. When constricted by finitude, it finally bears fruit. So I just created this with my PowerPoint artistic skills, Grandma's Homemade Agape. Take time for simple pleasures. And I don't think Cynthia Bergeau is exactly a grandma type. She's more of the crazy aunt who has a lot of relationships out there, but she is a gem and of great insight for us. And now we're going to switch over to Teilhard, and Teilhard's one of my heroes. He's like Indiana Jones as a monk. He pretty much did it all. I'm going to unpack this in a few slides, but he basically reflected on this covenant we have with God, that there is no God without creative union, that God up to a certain point just is kind of isolated in up there and not not in relation to anything. So there's nobody to reflect God back. So it almost has only meaning for that God or the Holy Triune. So there's no creation without incarnational immersion. So when God decides to create, what happens? The heart of God is in every part of creation. He's committed into every part of creation. And then there's no incarnation without redemptive repayment. And then he adds this footnote at the bottom that you have to go down and read, says specific effort towards unification, overcoming a sort of inertia and tendency to fall back into multiplicity. And I know that's wordy, but what he's basically saying is work effort, that the entropy, if we don't work on ourselves, we fall back into multiplicity and many eyes. So there's a strong, strong alliance between Teilhard and the work. In fact, you can find in J.G. Bennett's A Dramatic Universe, he refers to Teilhard, has a little bit of a theologic argument with him. So they're on the same page, basically. Now, Teilhard just wasn't up in an ivory tower thinking about things. He lived a life. He was fully fourth way. And he was a drafted, and he was a stretcher bearer. He was also became a chaplain. And this is a rare photograph. This is taken October 2016, right before the battle of Domont. The Battle of Domont, to kind of recover that fort. And they've got a museum there. And this photograph is in that museum at Domont. And this is Teilhard doing mass. And he got a Legion of Honor medal for his bravery. He was just impassive in the midst of war. And he always looked back on his time in World War I as his forging of his spiritual center, where he got a sense of God and got a sense of resonance within the universe. And this is a quote from a witness. He said, Germans sent a hail of shells down in our sector. Not a one of us was touched by the bursts. Teilhard said, I still had my blessings to give you. God being with us did not wish one of us to be hit. I asked Per Teilhard, what do you do to keep this sense of calm during battle? With a friendly smile, he said, if I am killed, I shall just change my state. That's all. And he says this, death surrenders us totally to God. It makes us enter into him. We must, in return, surrender ourselves to death with absolute love and abandonment. Since when death comes, all we can do is to surrender ourselves completely to the domination and guidance of God. I feel that there is something to say about the healthy joy of death, about its harmony in life, about the intimate connection yet barrier between the world of the living, about the unity of both in one and the same cosmos. Death has been treated too much as a subject for melancholy reflection, or as an occasion for self-discipline, or as a hazy theological entity. What we have to do is to see it in its true context, see it as an active reality, as one more phase in a world and a becoming. I love that quote. Teilhard died on April 10th, 1955. I was 3 years old. April 10th, 1955 was Easter Sunday. And the last entry in his journal was on Maundy Thursday, the night of the Lord's Supper. And he wrote down his beliefs in this typically legomenistic method. Maundy Thursday, what I believe. And he has these quotes from St. Paul that I'm going to share with you. En passi pantatheos, which is God is all in all, which is Christogenesis. So then in his deduction, he goes, cosmos is equals cosmogenesis that leads to biogenesis that leads to neogenesis. So the cosmos leads to life on Earth. And life on Earth increases in complexity. And in the future, we will have a newosphere where our highest being exists. And so he said that the universe is centered evolutely above and ahead, but Christ is at its center. And this is the quote from the St. Paul's from 1 Corinthians 15. The last enemy to be destroyed is death, for he has put everything under his feet. Now, when it says that everything has been put under him, it is clear that this does not include God himself, who put everything under Christ. When he has done this, then the Son himself will be made subject to him who put everything under him, so that God may be all in all. So this is the ultimate delegation. For us to destroy death is for us to reach back to God and to connect with God at the omega point or the pleroma. And we're not finished our journey. We haven't realized that, but we will get there. And so in the Mass on the World, that original version I was in the email was from the priest. The priest he wrote in 1918, and it was reflecting his experience in the First World, the Great War, and his experience about death in the Great War. And there was a bit of an edge of desperation and a sense of hazard in that. But he refined it a bit on the Mass of the World, and he saw it as the labors and the suffering of man, offering it up to God as the sacrament. And I'll just restate this annotated version. Since once again, Lord, I have neither bread nor wine nor altar, I will raise myself beyond these symbols, up to the pure majesty of the real itself. I, your priest, will make the whole world my altar, and on it will offer you all the labors and sufferings of the world, all the things in the world to which this day will bring increase, all those that will diminish, all those too that will die. All of them, Lord, I try to gather them into my arms so as to hold them out to you in offering. This is the material of my sacrifice, the only material you desire. This bread, our toil, is of itself, I know, but an immense fragmentation. This wine, our pain, is no more, I know, than a draft that dissolves. Yet in the very depths of this formless mass, you have implanted, and this I am sure of, for I sense it, a desirable, irresistible hallowing, which makes us cry out, believer and unbeliever alike, Lord, make us one. And I'm going to segue to Leonard Cohen, a favorite of Stephen Jenkinson's and a favorite of mine and a favorite of our church. he offered himself up as well. And I'm going to unpack this a little bit, and hopefully the video will take, we'll see. But at, near the end of his life, he had some regrets. As we do a review of our life, sometimes we have to face those down. He had an interesting life. He was very much an individualist, and he grew up in a wealthy Montreal suburb. His father was a haberdasher. He was always around fine clothes and learned to dress well. But he was into poetry and saw himself as a poet or a novelist, and traveled to Idra in Greece and bought a house and met this Norwegian lady by the name of Marianne Elan. And she had a son, Axel. She had divorced from her husband, who was sort of was a playwright, but played around a bit. And Leonard Cohen always used to say that Idra was a place that you couldn't live anywhere else after you lived in Idra, including Idra. It was a very seductive place, and sometimes you could get lost there. But he has this quote that he has near the end of his life. He said, "Greece is a good place to look at the moon, isn't it? You can read by moonlight. You can read on the terrace. You can see a face as you saw it when you were young. It was a good light then. Oil lamps and candles, and those little flames that floated on cork and olive oil. What I loved in my old life, I haven't forgotten. It lies in my spine. Mariana and the child and the days of kindness. It lives in my spine and it manifests as tears. I pray that a loving memory exists for them too. The precious ones I overthrew for an education in the world." And 3 months before Leonard Cohen died, he wrote Mariana as she was dying. She died 3 months before he did. And he said, "I'm just a little behind you, close enough to hold your hand. This old body of mine has given up as yours has too. I've never forgotten your love and your beauty, but you know I don't have to say more. Safe travels, old friend. See you down the road. Endless love and gratitude. Your Leonard." Well, Leonard Cohen had his career and went into a monastery, a Zen monastery in the mid-90s, spent 5 years there, emerged from it to discover that his business manager had embezzled his entire assets, his all his retirement. So that might seem something that would just devastate the rest of us, but he said, well, this is a good excuse to go on a world tour. So he enlisted the help of our very own Roscoe Beck, who was to the left of him there on that top photo. He was our bass player at church for 10, 15 years. His son was in our YES program. A very talented guy. We knew that he worked with the Dixie Chicks. I didn't know that he had produced famous Blue Raincoat, the Jennifer Warnes album of Leonard Cohen songs, but he organized these musicians on this world tour, and it was a huge success. I mean, it just blew the socks off every other tour at that time. And in that tour and in Dublin, he sang this song called "Come Healing." And it's actually a psalm rather than a song. And I'm hoping this will play. If it doesn't, we're going to send you a link so that you can listen to it yourselves. But he's almost in this liminal space talking to the demiurges, the angels, and the angels are the Webb sisters and Sharon Robinson, these wonderful singers. And he's kind of offering this penitential prayer as he's approaching the end of his life. And it's just a beautiful rendering. Let's see if it works.
So it's promises given to them. The soldiers that you carry, the cross you left behind, come healing of the body, come healing of the mind. Spirit, the potential healing, come healing of the spirit, come healing of the name.
Behold the gates of mercy, in arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace, or solitude of life, where love has been confined, come healing of the body, come healing of the mind. Come see the toil of life apart, come healing of the reason, come healing of the heart, divided love. The heart beneath is teaching to the broken heart above. And let the heavens falter, and let the earth proclaim, come healing of the answer, come healing of the name.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Did you catch the audio on that?
A little of it.
A little of it. Well, check it out on YouTube for a complete version of it. But and you probably heard it through my speakers backwards rather than the audio share, but we had a little technical difficulty there. But it's just I could listen to it 10 times a day. It's just so beautiful. So let's open things up for sharing. Three-centered experience with dying. Any of the homework, any of your reactions to what you feel tonight about this topic. I'm going to go to gallery view here so I can see everybody. There we go. Yeah, Dennis.
Well, I somewhere during the discussion, I guess you could call it having a future memory of how I like my passing to be, surrounded by family, my grandkids, my stepkids, my brothers and sisters, exes, the whole nine yards, and just have a grand, happy send-off and to tell everybody that I will be in their hearts.
That's beautiful, beautiful, Dennis, and blessings to you on that. Just keep pondering these things, you know. We have to, it's like Ram Dass always said, have death on your shoulder. Think about it all the time. What am I fulfilling my purpose? It's not getting as any hands up. I'm not getting gallery.
Yeah. Melba has her hand up.
Melba, go ahead. Let me just.
Thank you, Stephen.
Hey, Melba.
Hi. I was a little taken aback when I first read the email today, because this morning when I first woke up, I was having a conversation with my nephew who passed away 2 weeks ago. And I called me asking him some questions, and he was being kind of funny. And I asked him, has your experience been the way that I described to you when I had that near death experience? And he couldn't remember what I had told him. And then I opened up the email this afternoon, and I was like, oh no. But listening to your discussion, the thing that stuck with me is that Father Keaton's observation about the transformation, meaning that we're still alive, we're just in different costumes, what I think in my head, and it was the experience of listening to your words, and then this final piece with Leonard Cohen, something made me really happy, because as I started to think about the future of my passing, I feel confident that my send-off will be a moment where I can feel that I inspired a lot of people, and I've painted over 1,000 different paintings of people as roses. And so, and I'm going strong even now. So I'm all I could think of is I'm really grateful for all the challenges that I've had in my life, and I've had quite a few, like everyone else. And that somehow I was fortified to stand up again and take another go at it. In fact, I was really grateful for the way that the CC age community fortified me at my nephew's funeral, because this is like the seventh or eighth person that is close to me that has passed this year. But I noticed something really different. And I think I can say that having the community, the lessons, the Jenkins work that I studied in the seminars, the Journey School, and Gurdjieff's idea of vertical man as well. I mean, that's why I love the image that Mary Ann showed, because its skeleton and the woman are standing up. And I feel like I've been fortified in a very positive way to really be grateful and happy about the process of my life, because all along the way I have been fortified. I get to remember myself, and the CCH community this past 9 months or so, 10 months, has really fortified me so that I feel confident. Thank you.
Well, great, Melba. I'm glad to hear that, and we'll keep fortifying you.
Yeah, thank you.
And you can fortify us back. Yeah. Rebecca. Unmute. Did you unmute?
I now have.
Okay, good.
I just wanted to thank you, Stephen, for taking what was the more challenging route for your personality and presenting from your emotional center. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. It wasn't that hard. Anybody else? Well, it looks like we're close to time anyhow, so I'm going to hand it back to you, Marianne.
Well, thank you, Steve. What a blessing the whole evening has been. Wonderful food for us. And it would be good to send that link, I think, so we can go directly to the video. So thank you.
Sure.
So again, we'll close with this sentence of remembrance from Rodney Collin. Our heart is a mirror in which we see the reflection of the world. If God is in our heart, we see God everywhere. And so it is. So it is, dear ones. Let us now close our time by praying together the prayer that's an affirmation of God's love, that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully, and how blessed I am simply to remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest in Christ's peace. Amen.